beyond the tipping point, scientists and the environmental left can only envisage dystopia. I cannot find a single paper, a single scientific paper or case on the left challenging this fatalism. The dystopian fatalism begins with a cascade of tipping points, a domino effect where one tipping point triggers another. The domino effects include the melting of the Arctic and permafrost, the collapse of the Amazon, Boreal and other ecosystems. The fear is global warming spirals out of control and gradually erodes the habitability of our planet. These irreversible tipping points are almost with us. A recent paper published in Nature found there is a 1 in 6 chance, even if we stopped emissions today, that we've already locked in 1.5 degrees of warming, which may be enough to trigger the tipping points. The environmental left have accepted this scientific view. Green New Deal advocates and the school strike movement have shaped their political vision around preventing the tipping points, citing social catastrophe as the rationale. The leader of Extinction Rebellion, Roger Hallam, expresses a widespread view when he says, "Let's be frank about what catastrophe means. It actually means the slow and agonising suffering and death of billions of people." I will challenge this fatalistic orthodoxy in science and on the environmental left. I argue that fatalism is a product of a movement being trapped within the paradigm of capitalism. They lack both scientific and political imagination. There are, even within the limits of research set by capitalist priorities, glimpses of the kind of technological solutions for global warming, which could well be available for humanity if only we could break the stranglehold of capitalist drives for profits and competition. Coupled with this dystopian fatalism is hope in reforming the nation state as a means for solving the crisis. Even currents on the socialist left want us to believe that those driving us to catastrophe can be won by persuasion. This reflects an unwillingness to question how we can get control out of the hands of capitalists and their nation state. This reformism today is equivalent to accepting that capitalist dystopia becomes a reality, as that is all the system has to offer. I will argue beyond the tipping points, social adaptation and the reversal of global warming is possible, but only if we can build a society based on international collectivism. So it is the pace of warming that is of immediate concern. When accounting for climate feedbacks, the Paris climate target pathway would likely result in 3 degrees by 2050 and 5 degrees by 2100. Note that governments across the world are even failing to reach these quite conservative targets. Under this scenario, 2.5-degree warmer world would likely see an end of subsistence and smallholder farming in most of Africa and South Asia. A Lancet paper predicts that this would likely destroy the livelihoods of over a billion people. By 2050, at 3 degrees of warming, a paper in PNAS predicts 3 billion people would be living in a climate akin to the deadly Sahara Desert. Almost, possibly these 3 billion people would become climate refugees. By this time, desertification will have spread throughout Europe, South Asia, the Amazon, and Australia. In the US breadbasket region, on average, conditions would be equivalent to the US Dust Belt of the 1930s. By four degrees, the prominent British environmentalist Mark Lynas suggests a single heat wave or prolonged drought could threaten a year's harvest across virtually all the world's major food producing areas, perhaps all at once. While social adaptation may be possible for the vast majority, it has its limits. The 2015 Paris climate pledges, if followed unimpeded, risks a 5 or 6 degree warmer world this century. And with it, Earth's habitability may be on its knife edge. This is what Mark Lynas argues in his book, Our Final Warming. I agree, the possibility of social adaptation for the vast majority would be increasingly precarious. In this scenario, Earth's climate is so hostile that agriculture-supportive climates would only exist in scarce niche pockets in high altitudes and in polar regions. This pace of warming, unparalleled in Earth's history, would allow no time for ecosystems to adapt. The vast majority of society and agricultural systems would be dependent on artificial environments for its survival. The material limits or precarity of social adaptation would be likely determined by the following factors: the pace in which society can upscale renewable energy generation to power microclimates for agriculture and habitation, the capacity for society to safeguard fertile ecosystems in artificial environments, and the ability for infrastructure to withstand novel and extreme weather events. Social dependency on artificial environments means infrastructure would need to be 100% fail-proof in the face of extreme weather events that may include biologically uninhabitable climates or heat waves and cyclones so large they leave trails on the ocean floor, a scenario we want to avoid. An authoritative 2018 report by 10 of the leading Earth system scientists warns that a shift into a hothouse pathway is likely irreversible beyond 2 degrees because of the tipping points I mentioned earlier. These scientists drew up the conclusion that no human intervention could reverse a hothouse pathway trajectory. The idea that this pathway is irreversible remains unchallenged and broadly accepted amongst scientists, yet it's an unproven hypothesis. There have been no attempts to refute this hypothesis by modelling a shift from a hothouse pathway towards a stabilised and more habitable Earth system. To date, all climate modelling and technological solutions are framed around preventing a 1.5 to 2 degree threshold. This limited scope is unfortunate. A shift into a hothouse pathway presents new political and technological challenges that have received little attention from climate scientists and on the left. The Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change report is based on the most authoritative climate models in the world. They conclude to avoid a 1.5 to 2 degree threshold, a rapid energy transition is not enough. So in addition to a 45% emission cuts by 2030 and towards net zero by 2050, society will need to draw down vast amounts of carbon dioxide from the Earth's atmosphere. These quantities will only increase every year society continues to emit emissions. Whether we are solving the climate crisis today or the one in the hothouse Earth, society must implement large-scale carbon dioxide or CO2 removal technologies. That said, in a hothouse pathway, scientists doubt that society is capable of CO2 removal at the pace and magnitude necessary to compensate for the warming tipping points. Hence why they believe it's irreversible. I will summarise three of the most recognised so-called solutions capitalism has come up with. The first solution is championed by the liberal press and mainstream politicians to ignore the IPCC report recommendations and pollute according to the 2015 Paris Agreement emission reduction timeline. As discussed, this scenario risks the erosion of Earth's habitability. The second solution can be found in the 2018 IPCC report. So in addition to 45% cut for emissions by 2030, mass carbon dioxide removal will also need to take place. And this report rests on a technology called bioenergy and carbon capture storage, which I'll refer to as BECCS. BECCS requires vast plantations to withdraw vast quantities of carbon so it can be buried in the ground. To keep temperatures to 1.5 degrees, the IPCC report says BECCS must be implemented on 20 to 50% of arable and permanent crop area. That is fertile land at a scale equivalent to possibly 60% of currently used grown crops. But even that is contested. Some reports suggest it's equivalent to 100% of land. The IPCC report admits that it is not known whether BECCS is feasible to scale and the fertile land needed is not easy to find. The free market and capitalist governments will look to virgin forests as available land and care little for the existing integrity of ecosystems. So Earth's forests such as the Amazon are already on the brink of collapse due to logging and climate change. BECCS implemented to scale could destroy the last remaining forests, accelerate desertification and worsen climate change. A more humane and smaller scale application of BECCS could be part of a possible CO2 removal process alongside afforestation, ecosystem restoration, soil carbon sequestration, which in contrast to BECCS tends to expand biodiversity and natural carbon sinks. But regardless of the combination scientists end up deciding is most suitable, the only way it could work is if it's based on the rational implementation of science. But the state and capital is incapable of relating to Earth's ecosystems as anything but a commodity to exploit. To effectively draw down vast quantities of carbon, the environmental movement will need a fight for control over Earth's arable regions and the technology's implementation. The IPCC report modelling assumes BECCS and other carbon removal technologies will be implemented in a world no more than 1.5 degrees warmer. The research in their viability beyond 1.5 degrees is incredibly scarce. Considering majority of ecosystems which CO2 removal relies on may erode or collapse this century, existing technologies may not be viable in a warming world. This is where capitalism's third so-called solution comes in, another dystopian one. The 2018 IPCC report suggests an overshoot of 1.5 degrees target could be avoided through solar radiation management. It could artificially halt or reduce global warming by injecting aerosols into the stratosphere to reflect sunlight back into space. Stabilizing Earth's temperatures could give us more time and a stable climate, which may be necessary in order for CO2 removal technologies to remain feasible and gradually draw down carbon to an habitable range. If rationally implemented on a global scale, solar radiation management and carbon dioxide removal technologies may be able to engineer a new and habitable Earth system. However, capitalism's application of these technologies is anything but rational. Solar radiation management is deeply controversial on the environmental left and for good reason. The capitalist implementation could mark a disastrous era of climate imperialism. The IPCC report goes on to say an equitable governance arrangement around solar radiation management would have to reflect the views of different countries because unilateral action by one country could produce extreme weather effects across borders. Without such an internationally coordinated intervention, the risks may be too high. Early modelling suggests, for example, poor implementation risks the killing of monsoon rains in West Africa, India and Southeast Asia. And poor implementation is not difficult to imagine in a world of rivaled imperial nations. As climate change worsens, deadly droughts and heat waves may fuel deep social crisis. Desperate governments could look to solar radiation management to resolve national crises by altering climates and precipitation patterns to improve their situation at the expense of their neighbours. Dozens of countries already administer cloud seeding programs. China, thirsty for a larger cut of the region's water, is building a weather modification infrastructure over Tibet that expands the landmass three times the size of Spain. In time, such projects could trigger climate resource wars. While it may be needed to stabilise Earth's climate and prevent the erosion of capitalist government, and prevent the erosion of Earth's habitability, the environmental movement should not readily trust capitalist government to use the technology, nor can the movement afford to outright dismiss it playing a role in a climate solution. Here lies the tragic paradox. One of our movement's greatest tasks will be fight for an internationalist society capable of rationally and humanely applying such technologies. Beyond the tipping points, mass death is not inevitable like most environmentalists believe. Each death will be a result of capitalism's barbaric priorities. Social adaptation should be relatively straightforward as tech already exists. A solution to drought and fresh water depletion could be perpetual water recycling systems in urban centres and industry. If necessary, desalination plants can offer alternative supplies as it does in many Australian cities. The story is similar with food production. Yes, at 2, 3, or 4 degrees, agricultural land will begin to erode across the globe. However, surplus capacity of food production is large. Every human could be adequately fed with large-scale desertification. Food could be produced more efficiently. Today, we have enough of food. We have the capacity to feed equivalent to about 12 billion people, 60% more than today. Additionally, land could be used far more efficiently. A study found that eliminating the livestock industry could free up at least 75% of fertile land and still feed the world. Hunger and the lack of clean drinking water will continue to exist, not because of climate change, but due to the structural interests of agribusiness and global empires that put profit and power before human needs. If regions become uninhabitable, there is no rational reason why mass migration can't occur. We can build sustainable urban centres in other places in the world if needed. Society has the resources and labour. It's nation states' border walls and nationalist politics that get in the way. We also know that seeding ecosystems in urban landscapes cool our cities. And when combined with energy efficient housing, we could regulate city climates and build resilience to deadly heat waves. Beyond adaptation, the simplicity of solutions continue. The technologies exist to generate renewable energy and transition industry off greenhouse emissions. The solution for the biodiversity crisis is also simple: to stop logging, to allow ecosystems to repair themselves and seed novel ecosystems where necessary, from urban environments across continents, coasts, and in the ocean. All these solutions are common sense. They are not associated with socialism. Yet capitalism refuses to apply them. That said, scientific advancement will be necessary to enhance our ability to solve the crisis. Innovation has been held hostage by narrow interests of the already powerful capitalists that only invest in innovation that directly serve the profit motive or war, while other areas of research critical to solving the crisis are being starved of funds. To date, 48% of federal research and development funding goes to weapon enhancements in the US. On top of this, 70% of the US federal budget goes to the military. Imagine what could be possible if these resources went to solve the climate crisis. What about scientists themselves? Astrophysicists, engineers, and physicists are hired to improve weapons and to innovate weapons rather than to innovate renewable energy, geoengineering, and social adaptation technologies. Material scientists and chemists are funded to optimize profitable materials like plastics instead of designing materials suitable for industrial recycling. Biologists hoping to contribute to cures and diseases and restore ecosystems end up working on the next profitable drug. Similar to many fields, a revolution in the fields of ecology and climate restoration is ripe for the picking. At least 2/3 of species on Earth remain unknown, and 1/3 of the known species, fewer than 1 in 1,000, have been subject to intensive biological research. As these species and ecosystems are researched, we could enhance our ability to engineer ecosystems that can adapt to changing climates, increase food production, and the pace of CO2 removal. It is possible that new climate modification and CO2 removal technologies will surface and offer advanced methods of stabilising our Earth system, Hopefully revolutionary innovation means high-risk solar radiation management will prove unnecessary. Nobody knows what breakthroughs are possible. What we do know is capitalism is getting in the way of the next scientific revolution. The environmental movement struggles to envisage solutions because of their liberal politics, which accepts the permanence of capitalism with its rival nation states, its border walls, and control over the economy and nature. Even the socialist left, such as Andreas Malm, have illusions in the nation state's potential to turn on capital in order to solve the clock crisis. Nation states are an integral institution of the capitalist class. They relate to other nation states like chess pieces to dominate or defeat in a competitive race to monopolise resources and markets. The global trade of water, energy, and every commodity needed to solve the climate crisis functions in this way. The most powerful state wins, not the nation state best at limiting global warming. More immediate than removing CO2 is the issue of an energy transition. The problem is the transition away from fossil fuels is going to be far too slow and shallow under capitalism. The lifespan of global infrastructure and mines will consume double the CO2 that exists within the IPCC carbon budget. Almost the entire global supply chain needs to be decarbonised. The transition will be too slow because the ruling class will resist calls to reconstruct infrastructure and the global supply chain, not just because they want a profitable return on their investments and a transition is expensive, but because a carbonised economy plays a critical role in the global imperialist battle for increased dominance on the imperial stage. The transition will be too shallow because industries, in particular the military, cannot be decarbonised without nation states losing their military edge on a global scale, something no ruling class is willing to accept. This limits the depth of emission cuts that are possible without revolution. Then there is the CO2 removal issue. As discussed, rival nation states are incapable of uniting in a project to rationally draw down atmospheric CO2 and implement carbon radiation management. Such attempts may lead to disaster under capitalism. Then there is the potential need for billions to migrate to habitable regions. Nation states respond with brutality just like they do today. Border walls will need to be smashed and replaced with an international system for mass migration to be possible and humane. For the capitalist class, the competitive system makes rapid and far-reaching change impossible. Instead, capitalists will fight to defend carbonised infrastructure where it helps them expand global power. They will fight for border walls and their control over life's necessities, even if billions die and the world burns. Liberals and reformists look to the nation state to solve the climate crisis. It is no wonder then that all they can envisage is dystopia beyond the tipping points. To answer the question, is socialism possible in a hothouse pathway? Yes, it may be. It is also the only hope of a humane world and for the vast majority to survive this crisis. Even if we overshoot 1.5 or 2, 3 or 4 degrees in the depths of a hothouse pathway, it may still be possible to resurrect a stable, biodiverse and habitable planet. To heed the call of climate scientists, we need a fight for international socialism. There have been many talks at this conference on what a workers' revolution may look like and how we get there, so I will not go into this. Under capitalism, workers' agency over its labour and its conscious control with nature has been stripped away by capital. In contrast, a society collectively and democratically run by workers means that we would have control over our relationship with nature and be free to act as planetary stewards to consciously integrate and regulate social and natural systems. Workers would be armed with Earth system modelling to coordinate and the collective engineering project of rehabilitating our planet. If necessary, solar radiation management could reduce and stabilise temperatures, giving workers the time and conditions to withdraw CO2 by seeding novel ecosystems across the globe or using other supporting technologies. As atmospheric CO2 returns to stable levels, the Earth cools to an ideal range, solar radiation management would no longer be needed. Yes, tipping points may be reversible in the short and medium term, such as ecosystems collapsing into deserts, melting ice sheets, and ocean acidification. In time, over many generations, they too can be re-engineered. In order to stabilize a new and abundant Earth system, it's not just CO2 levels that need to be reduced. Many interconnected natural systems have been broken or shattered by capitalism and need to be repaired. A new biogeochemical planetary cycle needs to be established. And for example, to give context to that jargon, to solve the agricultural crisis, there needs to be an integration of society's relationship with nature, an integration of perpetual cycling of nutrients within ecosystems, agriculture, and society itself. The organic and industrial matter metabolized by society, from food to packaging to infrastructure, must have its place in the perpetual cycle of our Earth system. Earth's matter under socialism will be collectively shared through time and space. A liberated international working class will be free to reinvent its trades, to re-engineer an Earth system beyond what is thought possible. Social wealth and the productivity will be redefined and advanced within nature's cycles and limits, developing a sustainable foundation for humanity's creative and social potential. Along the way, the integration of cities with novel ecosystems and food cultivation would support the collective blossoming of creativity and innovation. Deserts and cities could bloom, and with it, hearts and minds. The environmental left often say that we do not have time for revolution. Last year, Andreas Malm wrote, and I quote, "Waiting for revolution would be delusional and criminal, and so all we have to work with is the dreary bourgeois state tethered in the circuits of capitals as always." Fighting for socialism is not about waiting. It is about building a revolutionary movement, not a movement deluded in the fanciful idea that the capitalist state can save humanity. Building a revolutionary current will strengthen our fight for reform today. In order to force radical reforms Marms and others hope for, mass movements and sabotage will not cut it. To realise deep social change, a movement will need to threaten the power of the capitalist class itself with militant working class action. Ultimately, workers will need to take collective control. None of this is inevitable. The politics of organisations intervening in and being part of struggles will play a role in determining the direction they go. In our generation, accepting the capitalist state will save us is basically conceding to their dystopian reality, conceding to their dystopias becoming reality, with elites sheltering in climate-controlled areas while majority of the population diminishing in number, living in unbearable conditions just to service them. Yes, billions will be at risk of dying beyond the tipping points. Who knows how many billions will need to be wiped off this planet so the elite can survive in the hothouse Earth. This urgency will not persuade the capitalist state to act. In quiet times, capitalism kills millions year after year through war, pandemics, and the lack of clean drinking water. The death toll may grow considerably in the coming decades. This would be tragic, but it will not prevent the possibility of revolution. It will give us more reason to fight like hell for socialism. So to conclude, it is not the time factor that leads to hopelessness, like Andreas Malm and others, I think, fall into. The dystopian fatalism found in science and on the environmental left is a product of the limited political scope of liberals and reformists and the lack of an organised revolutionary alternative today. A revolutionary wing needs to be built within the climate movement. It needs to aspire to lead a struggle to overthrow capitalism. Only by inspiring a revolutionary hope that a beautiful and abundant world is still possible can we crack and one day shatter the dystopian fatalism that haunts society at large.